hereafter. It is irony that with a religion of God, that there's a Muslim country, the assembly and association that is formed for the purpose of spreading evil and mischief should be the right rule over the country, an association and party which have been formed for propagating righteousness and virtue should live in perpetual fear and harassment and being declared illegal. Condition here are just the reverse of what has been prescribed by God. The claim that is, we are Muslims and this is an Islamic state, but the work that is being done directing to spreading evil, to corrupt, morally disgrace and disgrace the people, well, there is an active and effective check on the wrong and on the work being carried out, the reforming society, inviting people to righteousness. More the people of those who are engaged in spreading righteousness and checking the spread of evil and wickedness is made intolerable and hard to bear. Well, when you talk about the freedom of conscience and conviction, Islam has also given the right of freedom and conscience and conviction and its own citizen in Islamic State. The Holy Quran has laid down the injunction. There should be no coercion in the matter of faith. Chapter number 2, verse number 256. Though there's a truth and virtue greater than the religion of true Islam, and the Muslims enjoin to invite and embrace Islam and advance argument in favor of it, they're not asked to enforce this faith on them. No force will be applied in order to compel them and accept Islam. Whosoever accepts it does not by his own choice. Muslim will welcome such a convert to Islam with open arms and admit him in the community with equal rights and privileges. But if somebody does not accept Islam, Muslim have to recognize and respect his decision, and no moral, social, and political pressure will be put on him to charge his mind. Let's take a break. We'll be right back and continue even further.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, before the break, we talked about the freedom of consension and conviction, that if you see that there is someone who's not willing to accept Islam, well, Islam says don't just force your religion to him, because there's no force in Islam. So protection of righteous sentiments. Yeah, Islam even talks about it. What do you think? Islam is just not like Western world. They don't talk about the human rights like hypocrisy. But Islam talks about everything in detail. Well, along with the freedom of conviction and freedom of conscience, Islam has given the right to individuals that the righteous sentiments will be given due respect and nothing will be said and done with which encroach upon his right. It has been ordered by Allah in the Holy Quran, do not abuse those who appeal to instead of God. Chapter number 6, verse number 108. These instructions are not only limited to idols and deities, but they also apply to the leaders of nation and heroes of the people. If a group of people holds a conviction which according to you is wrong, and holds certain person is high esteem which according to you is not deserved by them, then it will not be justified in Islam that you use abusive language for them and thus injure them with their feelings. Islam does not prohibit people from holding debates and discussion and righteous matter, but if it wants these discussions should be conducted in decency. Do not argue with the people of the book unless it is the politest manner. Chapter number 29, verse number 46. Says the Quran, this order is not merely limited to the people of scriptures, but applies with equal force to those following other faiths. Protection from adherity, imprisonment. When you talk about this, Islam has also recognized the rights of individuals that will be arrested and imprisoned for the offense to others. Though the Quran has laid down in this principle clearly, no bearer of burden shall be made bear and burden of another. Chapter number 6, verse number 164. Islam believes in a person's responsibility. We ourselves are responsible for acts, and that the consequences of our actions cannot be transferred to someone else. In other words, this means that every man is responsible for his action. If another person has not shared his action, then has cannot be held responsible for it. cannot be arrested. It is a matter of great regret and shame that we're seeing. This is just an equitable principle that has not been framed by one human being, but the creator and the nourisher and the entire universe being flouted and violated before our eyes, so much so that a person is guilty for a crime and is a suspect, that his wife being arrested for his crime. Things have been gone so far that innocent people are being punished for the crime of others. To give a recent example, in a country, a man was suspected of being involved in bomb-throwing incident. In the course of police investigation, he was subjected to horrible torture in order to extract a confession from him. When he insisted on his innocence, the police arrested his mother, his wife, his daughter, and sister and brought them to police station. They were all stripped and naked in presence, and he was stripped and naked for his wife's clothes before his own eyes and for the confession of the crime could extract it from him. And appears as the sake of investigation of crime, it has become proper and legal to our country to strike the innocent women folk and of the household in order to bring pressure on the suspect. This is indeed very outward and shameful. This is the heights of meaningless and depravity. This is mere harshly which has been repeated here, and I have full information about this case and can prove my allegation in the court law. I would here like to ask, what right such tyranny who prepared these crimes against mankind have to tell us that the Muslim or their the conduct the affairs of the state according to the teachings of Islam, and in their states of Islamic state, they're branching and flouting a fresh law of Old Quran. They're stripping men and women naked, which is strictly forbidden in Islam. They disgrace, humiliate humanity, and then they claim that they're what? A Muslim. Astaghfirullah. Well, that is it for today. Don't forget to visit our website, which is www.parstoday.com, and click on the tab Call of Islam, where you can find our programs as well as this one. And you can email us and contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. With that being said, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa ali nabiyil azim. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa ali nabiyil azim. اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم.
In the limelight. Saudi Arabia's use of American diplomatic cover and weapons alike has taken on a fevered pace as the kingdom deepens the tragedy it has inflicted upon Yemen, says Ahmad Abdul Karim Ryder in an article published under the heading, Yemen, Trump is showering Saudi Arabia with last-minute gifts. Stay tuned for the details, please. While the administration of Donald Trump readies its exit from the White House and the West Asia region, Saudi Arabia's use of American diplomatic cover and weapons alike has taken a fevered pace as the kingdom deepens the tragedy it has inflicted upon Yemen, where millions of forgotten people are struggling against a cold winter, starvation, epidemics, and the worst blockade in the modern era. Since November 3, 2020, when the 59th quadrennial presidential election began, followed by the widespread controversy, lawsuits, and recounts across several states, the oil-rich kingdom has waged a scorched-earth campaign against the Yemeni districts of Ma'arib, Al-Jawf, as well as border areas in Sana'a, Sa'deh, Hajjah, Amran, and Hudaydah. Recently, Saudi warplanes struck populated neighborhoods in Sana'a, with at least 20 airstrikes. One person was killed and dozens were injured, and a number of purebred Arabian horses were killed in the strikes that hit a military college near Sokh al-Arauda. Seven airstrikes hit government buildings located near water pumps. Thousands of tons of Western weapons, particularly from the United States of America, were also dropped on multiple directorates across the provinces of Sa'da, Marib and Al-Jawf, as well as districts and provinces across the country. The unjustified escalation, which came on the back of a brief period of hope that briefly preceded the U.S. pre-election, was not only a last-minute gift to Saudi Arabia from the Trump administration before he leaves the White House in January, but also served to prevent the advance of the Yemeni army supported by the Ansarullah movement and tribal fighters in the oil-rich province of Marib. On the Yemen-Saudi border, an intense Saudi bombing campaign aims to force the remaining residents in the area to flee. Saudi Arabia seeks to establish buffer zones on the border inside Yemeni territory in anticipation of any developments made by the incoming U.S. administration after Riyadh failed to achieve that goal through indirect negotiations with Sana'a, sources told Mint Press. In retaliation for Saudi escalation, the Yemeni army and Ansarullah movement targeted Saudi Arabia's vital oil sector, striking an oil facility in the kingdom, Red Sea city of Jeddah. The facility was targeted by the high-precision Quds II winged missile, a new generation of locally made winged missiles that recently entered service after successful test. In the wake attack, videos circulated on social media show a column of smoke rising from burning flames at the facility as sirens of emergency vehicles can be heard in the background. The move just days before news was leaked that the British government secretly sent British soldiers to protect Saudi oil facilities in the wake of a similar attack in 2009 and occurred the day after the kingdom hosted a virtual summit of G20 nations. The spokesman for Yemen's Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari, said in a statement recently, in the wake of the attack, that the Saudi oil facility was targeted in response to ongoing Saudi military operations and blockade. He warned foreign companies operating in Saudi Arabia to avoid vital installations which could be involved in ongoing operations. The strike was meant to send a signal to both Saudi Arabian regime and the Zionist regime, according to officials in Sana'a. The strike against the Aramco facility, located more than 390 miles from Yemen's border, underscores Yemen's increasing ability to hit targets deeper inside Saudi Arabia with cruise and ballistic missiles as well as drones. A high-ranking source in Sana'a told Mint Press that the consequences of any insane recklessness by Saudi Arabia, the Zionist regime, or the current U.S. administration in the last time of Trump's term will be dire to Riyadh, Tel Aviv, and the interests of their allies in the region. When pressed, he gave no additional details. An explosion took place as a result of a terrorist attack by a projectile, causing a fire in a fuel tank at the petroleum products distribution terminal in the north of Jeddah, the Saudi Energy Ministry said in a statement. Recently, Abdullah Al-Gamdi, the manager of the North Jeddah bulk plant, told reporters during a tour of the facility that one of the 13 tanks used for diesel oil, gasoline and jet fuel at the facility had been damaged and was out of service, adding the attack had been similar to what happened at Khurais and Abaqir. We'll be right back. As the kingdom's policy since 2015, when its war began, Saudi Arabia sold the attack to the world as targeting international interest. The kingdom went further and baselessly accused Ansarullah movement of attacking an oil tanker in the Red Sea. A Maltese-flagged oil tanker managed by Greece was damaged due to an explosion near Shoghaig in southwestern Saudi Arabia, but Ansarullah has not yet claimed responsibility for the incident. Prior to that, the Saudi-led coalition claimed recently that it had removed and destroyed five naval mines in southern Red Sea. 15 Saudi troops, including officers, were killed or injured in another retaliatory attack, this one marking the Saudi-led coalition Tadawain camp in Ma'rib, 20 kilometers east Sana'a, according to Brigadier Yahya al-Sari, spokesperson of the Yemeni army. Sari said in a statement recently that missile forces hit the joint operations room of a coalition camp in Ma'rib, killing 8 Saudi troops and injuring 7. He added that Yemeni forces are observing enemy movements and will target them wherever they are. In the wake of Sari's announcement, Saudi state media announced that Saudi troops were killed in battle with no mention of where or when they were killed. For his part, Mohammed Abdul Salam, spokesperson for Ansarullah, said that Saudi wailing following every painful retaliation is what is required. He added, the international community has to pressure Saudi Arabia regime to stop the aggression and the blockade because the Yemeni people deserve to voice their suffering too. Yemen suffers from the world's worst humanitarian crisis sparked by 5 years of Saudi regime bombing and blockade supported by the United States of America. The humanitarian crisis has worsened this year as international donations have dried up and the Trump administration has suspended aid to the north of Yemen where most of the country's population lives. The UN, the Secretary General warned last week that Yemen faces the worst famine in decades, saying that the country is in imminent danger and that without immediate action, millions of lives may be lost. U.S. policy in Yemen has been a disgrace for the past 5 years, drawing ire on U.S. soil and from abroad. And few Yemenis were surprised that the Trump administration would enact such a policy on its way out the door after having already suspended aid to 80% of the population residing in north of the country. The lives of millions of vulnerable children in Yemen are already at risk. This policy will only deepen their suffering by further restricting humanitarian access to vulnerable communities. Recent evidence continues to point to a worsening malnutrition crisis for children, said Janti Soprito, the president and CEO of Save the Children. Even if a humanitarian exemption is permitted, this designation will likely make reaching children and families more difficult and could also heighten security risks for staff and hinder the fragile peace process.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bye. European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. Here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercker movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus. European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. Here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercker movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a leading nuclear scientist, was assassinated in a terrorist attack on Friday. Iran's defense ministry said the top scientist was seriously wounded after attackers targeted his car and exchanged fire with his bodyguards in the town of Absard to the east of capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh later died from his injuries in hospital. Fakhrizadeh was Iran's most renowned nuclear scientist, who headed the Ministry of Defense's Research and Innovation Organization. His assassination prompted outrage in the country, with officials blaming Israel for the terrorist attacks and pledging retaliation. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called for those involved in the assassination of Fakhrizadeh to be brought to justice.
It is evident terrorism has targeted the scientific progress of the Islamic world in general, and the Islamic Republic in particular. The first and foremost reason for this hostility is our development, is our progress, is our self-sufficiency, is the strength of our fists at this very moment as we shout out loud what is just and inflict upon it the truth.
And Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called Fakhrizadeh's assassination a proof of enemies' desperation.
This terrorist act indicates the enemy's failures in political fronts in the region as well as across the world. The assassination of the scientist suggests the extent of enemy's malice and garage toward Iran's scientific capabilities and achievements. The killing of figures like Fakhrizadeh will not weaken Iran's will to move toward scientific development and progress. Rather, it makes Iranians more resolute in their path.
Fakhrizadeh's name was specifically mentioned in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's presentation about Iran's nuclear program in April 2018. At the time, Netanyahu said he identified Fakhrizadeh as the head scientist in the program and urged people to remember that name.
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said there are, quote, serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. He urged the international community, especially the European Union, to end, quote, their shameful double standards and condemn the assassination of the nuclear scientist. Zarif was referring to a trial in Belgium where four Iranian diplomats were accused of plotting a bomb attack in Paris. One of the latest projects that Fakhrizadeh was involved in was the development of the first indigenous COVID-19 test kit. U.S. sanctions prevent Iran from accessing medicine and humanitarian goods during this pandemic. The top scientist was also supervising the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2012, with Tehran and Western intelligence agencies blaming Israel for those killings. The Israeli terror campaign has been widely seen as a project to stymie Iran's peaceful nuclear activities, which have been under intense scrutiny of the United Nations Nuclear Agency.
Zionism, imperialism, the whole Western blood-soaked empires that assassinate, that murder, bomb, and displace, and then justify their crimes through propaganda, just like they did throughout the colonization epoch, where what I believe is that wherever in the world there is oppression, there will be a struggle. And wherever in the world there is a struggle, we shall be there. And if they think that they are threatened, well, because they are the oppressors.
This assassination follows a not-so-secret meeting in Saudi Arabia between the Saudi foreign minister and Israeli prime minister last week. It sent another signal that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Benjamin Netanyahu see this window as their last best chance in a while to try to inflict a crippling blow on Iran. Experts believe Riyadh and Tel Aviv are seeking to complicate an already challenging course for a new U.S. team to re-engage with Iran. The U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the 2015 Iran deal in 2018. Since then, Washington carried out what it called a maximum pressure campaign against Iran and imposed massive sanctions against the country. But future President of the United States, Joe Biden, has pledged to re-engage with Iran when he becomes U.S. president in January, despite long-standing opposition from Israel.
Sorry.
Up until now, the EU have played the winning hand on every account as they face off with the British over a post-Brexit trade deal. Yet as the deadline fast approaches for the British to beg the EU to adhere to some kind of trade rules, desperate measures may be taken in the 11th hour of the negotiations. With many of the big players in the EU very much in favour of the bloc, the French have urged the EU chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, to remain firm and stick to the plan, compelling him to stay tough on the approach the EU takes with the British. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, recently stated that any deal is now down to the friends and partners of the EU. Yet the message Boris Johnson must understand is that the very best deal he can expect to get would still have to be less favourable than the worst conditions of staying in the EU. Otherwise, what's the point of having an EU? So is this the future that Britain truly wishes to pursue? However, it seems that the EU is fast running out of patience with the British, with Barnier almost calling it a day recently, stating that there was no point negotiating over a lost cause, as it was clear that Britain was in no mood to make any commissions with the EU. Yet it seems that the EU lead has been reassured between the lines by the British chief negotiator, David Frost, that Britain may have no choice but to align to EU requests, much to the distaste of the British. So was the real reason that the EU agreed to more talks is because the British have finally realised that they must secure some kind of deal or face the perils of being a lonely piece of land floating off the coast of Europe with no friends, a shattered economy, and left in a position facing the realisation that the notion of stronger together was coined for the EU for a real good reason. When Dominic Cummings left Downing Street with his tail between his legs, there was an air of celebration in the UK as many people finally saw the back of a man who masterminded Brexit, yet on the other hand, breached the travel rules during the lockdown, making him public enemy number one. Yet with Cummings now gone, could this be an excuse for Boris Johnson to change his stance when it comes to negotiating with Europe, using Cummings as a scapegoat along the way for all the previous failures and weak negotiating skills against the EU, and leading Britain from his armchair in self-isolation? But the question is just how much Boris Johnson is being kept in the loop when it comes to the final rounds of talks, in particular as he is in isolation. Does the Prime Minister have the influence he may have had in person while sat at home? With the British now in a weaker than ever position since the apparent news that Joe Biden will become the next President of the United States, in particular when it comes to the handling of the situation in the north of Ireland, it seems that even as the talks near their final stages, the British are no closer to being able to come away from the talks with any hope of relying on a transatlantic trade deal, as Biden, as we all know, is a very different man from Trump. With the UK facing a very bleak Christmas and New Year due to the ongoing COVID-19 virus, as well as the notion that it may very well find itself without any trade partners come 2021, it seems that all measures must now be taken to somehow agree terms with the EU, and from there, somehow convincing the rest of the world that Little Britain is worth trading with, over and as opposed to trading with the might of the European Union.
The Israeli regime finally released Palestinian President Maher al-Akhras on Thursday. Al-Akhras had refused food for over 100 days in protest against his so-called administrative detention. He is now extremely frail, but says his prolonged hunger strike, which he ended on November 8th, has paid off. Al-Akhras says his freedom is the freedom of his people and an important win over the Israeli occupation. The 49-year-old Palestinian farmer from Salat ad-Daher in the north of the occupied West Bank began his hunger strike in July. His decision to refuse food was a bid to draw attention to Israel's widely condemned use of administrative detention. His hunger strike, which brought him to the brink of death, made headlines around the world, once again highlighting Israel's gross violation of human rights against Palestinian prisoners. His refusal to eat triggered a wave of condemnation of his administrative detention. The United Nations, the European Union, many rights groups and governments called for his release. Al-Akhras was one of hundreds of Palestinian inmates currently held in Israeli jails without charge or trial. Israel extensively uses its notorious administrative detention policy against Palestinians. That policy allows the regime to hold the inmates indefinitely without providing any evidence of wrongdoing. The notorious detention policy in Palestine is nothing new. It has been ongoing for many decades. It dates back to the British Mandate and has since been used by the Israeli regime.
The British developed it to crush the Palestinian anti-colonial movement when Britain was the colonial power until 1948. The Israelis have picked it up, they have refined it, they play cat and mouse with hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, as you say, detained without charge, and who are sometimes even taken to the very day of their release, sometimes even allowed outside the prison gates and immediately snatched, kidnapped and taken back inside for another 6 month period.
For Palestinians, spending time in Israeli jails is a common experience. Some estimates show around one-fifth of the total Palestinian population has gone through detention in Israeli jails since 1967. That's over 700,000 people. There are currently several thousand Palestinian inmates, including a large number of children in Israeli prisons. Appalling conditions and harsh treatment are indispensable parts of the terrible experience. Many Palestinian inmates say Israeli forces tortured them while in custody. Many have also complained of medical negligence. Reports show inmates who suffer from dangerous chronic illnesses are only given painkillers. Meanwhile, poor present conditions are making incarceration increasingly dangerous during the coronavirus pandemic. For instance, dozens of Palestinian prisoners have tested positive for the highly contagious disease inside the Israeli prison of Gilboa. Those with pre-existing health conditions could easily lose their lives. Protests against unbearable prison conditions have grown in recent years, including several high-profile hunger strikes, but they have rarely forced Israel to take action.
We need to start telling their stories, because the story of the prisoners is the story of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. It's a central aspect of that struggle, and I think we need to tell that story. We need to organize in a way where groups in different countries around the world can focus on particular groups of Palestinian prisoners, men, women, children, and tell their story and tell the whole world the horrors that Palestinians suffer.
The international community has been pretty loud in condemning Israel's violation of human rights against the Palestinians, including the rights violations inside its prisons. But the verbal condemnation has done little to change the regime's behavior. This could have been much different if governments had used their economic leverage with Israel to pressure it to change direction.
In the limelight.
According to Feeding America, the largest hunger relief organization in the U.S., more than 50 million people will experience food insecurity by the end of the year. Among U.S. children, the figure rises to 1 in 4. The group, which runs a network of some 200 food banks across the nation, says it distributed over 500 million meals last month alone, a 52% increase from an average pre-pandemic month. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Hunger Like They Have Never Seen It Before. U.S. food banks struggle as 1 in 6 families with children don't have enough to eat. Here's the details of this article. One in six U.S. families with children don't have enough to eat this holiday season, a national emergency exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic and the unemployment crisis it has generated. Over the past several days, remarkable reporting in the Washington Post and National Geographic, among other outlets, has explored this alarming trend. According to Feeding America, the largest hunger relief organization in the U.S., more than 50 million people will experience food insecurity by the end of the year. Among U.S. children, the figure rises to 1 in 4. The group, which runs a network of some 200 food banks across the nation, says it distributed over 500 million meals last month alone, a 52% increase from an average pre-pandemic month. The latest U.S. Census Bureau pandemic survey, published earlier this month, found that fewer than half of U.S. households with children were very confident they could afford to provide enough food for their families in the next month. As is so often the case when it comes to matters of economic inequality, Black, Latino, and Indigenous communities are disproportionately impacted by the hunger crisis. Among the 25 U.S. counties experiencing the worst food insecurity, only 4 have majority white populations, all of them in rural Kentucky. Census Bureau data reveals that fully 27% of Black and 23% of Latino households with children reported not having enough to eat over the past week, compared with just 12% of white families. This is a story about racial and ethnic disparities, both food insecurity and the story of coronavirus. Emily Engelhard, Managing Director of Feeding America Research Unit, told National Geographic, "The populations and geographies that started in the most disadvantageous state of food insecurity are the ones that are getting hit the hardest during the pandemic. People are seeing hunger like they've never seen it before." Trisha Cunningham, president of the North Texas Food Bank, where cars lined up for miles and people slept in their vehicles waiting for Thanksgiving food boxes, told National Geographic, "On November 14th, its busiest day on record, North Texas Food Bank provided groceries, including 7,000 whole turkeys, to more than 25,000 people." In northeastern Ohio, the Greater Cleveland Food Bank planned to distribute 12,000 meals, a 5,000 meal increase from a year ago. "We are now seeing families who had an emergency fund, but it's gone, and they are at the end of the rope," Christine Warzoka, president of the Greater Cleveland Food Bank, told The Guardian. "We are going to be doing this for a really long time, and that's frankly terrifying, given the impact hunger has on physical health, learning, and development for children and parents' stress." In Texas' second largest city, the San Antonio Food Bank distributes 8 semi-trucks full of food every day, but it still was forced to resort to rationing due to soaring need. "COVID-19 has taken so much, people's jobs, their loved ones, and now we're just trying to stop it from taking Thanksgiving," San Antonio Food Bank CEO Eric Cooper told CNBC. "Pre-pandemic, we were feeding around 60,000 people a week, and now we are seeing around 120,000, and most of those are new to the food bank. They've never had to ask for help before," he added. Indeed, among the thousands of cars that lined up starting in the pre-dawn hours for free Thanksgiving meals at Houston NRG Stadium last weekend, there were more than a few luxury makes. "I was just telling my mom, you'll look at people pulling up in Mercedes and stuff, come on," Randy Young, a recently laid-off cook at the stadium who was waiting in line with his elderly mother, told the Post. "If a person driving a Mercedes is in need of food, you know it's bad. It's been hard to survive, Young said. Money's low, no jobs, hard to find work. London County, Virginia is per capita the wealthiest county in the nation, with a median household income of just under $140,000. Yet the Post reports London Hunger Relief recently handed out meals to 887 households in one recent week, a 300% increase from pre-pandemic activity. We are continuing to see people who have never used services before, Jennifer Montgomery, London Hunger Relief Executive Director, told the Post. In the U.S. largest city, Food Bank for NYC President Leslie Gordon told France 24 that even before the pandemic, there were 1.5 million residents here across the five bureaus who didn't always know where their next meal was coming from or what it would be, and that's escalated considerably to nearly 2 million of the neighbors. Across the U.S., demand has not let up, and food banks do everything they can to make sure families have food on the table for Thanksgiving, Zoani Villarreal, a spokesperson for Feeding America, told The Guardian. There is no end in sight, but we can't be the only solution. Celia Call, CEO of Feeding Texas, stressed to the Post that without sustained aid at the federal level, we will be hard-pressed to keep up with demand. We're just bracing for the worst, she added. Several progressive lawmakers tweeted the Post article over the past 2 days. One of them, Representative Rokana, said that Congress has the power to address this crisis and asked, why aren't we doing it?
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela host a virtual seminar at the UN headquarters in Vienna on unilateral sanctions and their impacts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The three countries are under crippling US sanctions that have added extra pressure as they struggle to fight the coronavirus. Banking restrictions resulting from the sanctions are affecting the country's ability to obtain medical equipment, a point highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Iran's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna, Kazem Gharibabadi, said as the world's biggest imposer of unilateral sanctions, the U.S. should be held accountable for the consequences of its actions.
These sanctions violate human rights in the current circumstances. In our country, we also face a problem in importing medicine and medical equipment from abroad as a result of these cruel, unilateral, coercive measures and banking restrictions. Those who impose these sanctions have international responsibilities.
The Cuban ambassador said many countries are unaware of the impact that these sanctions are having on countries' healthcare systems and people's normal day-to-day lives.
As a result of this seminar, we will try to impulse all declaration in all resolution of United Nations to include the request to the United States and the other country and the European country who impose unilateral coercive measure to lifting those measures as the Secretary General of the United Nations requests and the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
In a joint statement, representatives of 38 participating countries said unilateral coercive measures are against international law, human rights, and the UN Charter.
Under the current circumstances caused by the coronavirus, they said, sanctions have made targeted countries vulnerable and need to be lifted. Homa Lesgi, Vienna.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaz is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights on which or for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States, but also trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal? Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Minister's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge. We will punish all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Venezuela's judiciary has convicted a group of former oil executives who plotted with the U.S. government against the interests of the South American country Citgo Petroleum Corporation, which is based in the United States. The judicial ruling comes at a time when Caracas is fighting to regain control of Citgo, as the company was illegally confiscated by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. Citgo's former executives were found guilty of passing secret information to American authorities in order to inflict damage on Venezuela's oil industry, a misconduct that is regarded as a major crime in Venezuela. In this scenario, officials support the judicial verdict.
The judge's decision is aimed at protecting our country's oil industry from U.S.-funded spies like ex-Citgo executives.
On the flip side, the opposition criticizes this legal case.
There is not enough evidence of conspiracy between the former executives and the U.S., so this court ruling is politically motivated.
Nonetheless, experts say the country's judiciary issued the right verdict.
The former executives are the Venezuelans who hold U.S. citizenship. That's a felony itself, in case you are the manager of a Venezuelan company.
Venezuela's judiciary has punished the former oil executives for their complicity with the U.S. Analysts say this is part of Caracas's legal actions to get back Citgo, the oil company that was illegally confiscated by Washington.
Jesús Silva, Caracas.
Are you